This is The Cable.
How much retail ownership is in stock?
Tech story is front and center.
What will this wind up doing to the cost curve?
Your connection from the London market close to the US market action.
A significant sell-off in European assets.
But it feels like a lot of these stocks have already priced that in.
This is a stock that is increasingly being shorted.
The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele.
Behavioral challenges from the pandemic could linger for years
on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB Digital Radio. I'm Guy Johnson in London alongside Alex Steele in New York. It's great to be back. Today the trains are running, so yeah, I can be here, which is fantastic. Tomorrow, not so much. We're going to talk about strikes in a few minutes' time. Alex, oh my Lord, we are seeing something of a sell-off developing. The Euro stocks today down by 3.5%. Most continental equity markets are down by a similar amount. The FTSE's getting away with it a little bit because of the fact that oil stocks are relatively outperforming. Mm-hmm. The Bank of England was boring today. The ECB wasn't.
We're down 100 points on the S&P. Now, some are saying that might be a delayed reaction to the ECB, but I got to be honest with you, I don't know if I buy that because we really picked up steam after the ECB. And you're taking a look at the front end of the yield curve here in the U.S., just up 3 basis points. If we're really freaking out about a hawkish Fed, we'd be up a lot more than that. I don't know. I think this is definitely the ECB taking the hawkish reins and, like, running with it.
No kidding. The complete kind of about face by Christine Lagarde today was bewildering. And there's been subsequent Bloomberg reporting that seems to suggest that actually there were many on the governing council that were talking about not a 50 basis point hike today, but a 75 basis point hike today. So absolutely amazing. In terms of the bond market, we're getting a big reaction there as well. Italy in particular, you're seeing Italian yields rising by 27 basis points. You've now got the Italian 10-year at 4.13. There's some suggestion now that the ECB may be hiking up towards 4%. That would put BTPs well north of where they are now and potentially start to maybe cause problems with the fabric of the ECB.
Yeah.
The German Bund spread could become quite problematic.
Yeah, and unless the ECB doesn't care that much about financial stability anymore, they're willing to look past it.
Yeah. We're going to find out in just a moment. We're going to discuss this a lot. Marcus Ashworth is lined up. We need to talk about the ECB. We need to talk about Fed. We need to talk about the Bank of England. Jana Randa is going to join us as well from Frankfurt to give us her take on what we saw with that Christine Lagarde press conference. Let's pull it all together now. Talk about the headlines. Here's Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much, Guy Johnson. Here's what's going on. Central banks on both sides of the Atlantic, certainly very much in focus. The Bank of England raising rates for a 9th time in a row to a 14-year high of 3.5%. Pressing ahead with efforts to tame sky-high inflation, the 9-member Monetary Policy Committee split 3 ways on the decision as officials tried to balance the risk of inflation getting entrenched against squeezing too hard on growth just as the economy enters a recession. The European Central Bank increased interest rates by 0.5 point, with President Christine Lagarde telling investors to prepare for a long-running campaign of similar moves to quell the worst inflation in the history of the euro. In other news, Citigroup has told employees they can work from anywhere for the final 2 weeks of the year as CEO Jane Fraser bucks a trend among rivals to get office workers back to their desks full-time. And baggage handlers at Heathrow will go ahead with a strike tomorrow and the weekend, with additional industrial action planned over New Year's Eve that threatens to disrupt one of Europe's most important aviation hubs. The Unite Union says more than 400 workers at Heathrow Terminals 2, 3, and 4 will walk out following a, quote, miserable pay offer from their employer. That is the latest from the news desk. Guy Johnson, back to you now in London.
Thank you very much indeed, Charlie Pellett. We're going to come back and talk about those strikes in just a moment because it's going to have a significant impact on the UK economy, and we need to figure out how we're going to be factoring that in. But let's turn first of all to what has been happening with the central bank narrative today. The Fed last night sounded hawkish. The market didn't believe it, as a result of which we didn't see much of a market reaction. Today, though, we have certainly seen a reaction. The ECB's Christine Lagarde sounding significantly more hawkish than anybody had anticipated. And by contrast, the Bank of England sounded boring. Marcus Ashworth joins us now to discuss all of this. Marcus, how would you compare and contrast these three central banks and the relative impact that they have had?
Well, I think you can safely say the Bank of England is just in lockstep with the Fed. And I think I'm even more confident that we will get another 25 basis points from the Bank of England, and that'll be it. I think the Fed may possibly be doing something similar, maybe a little bit more, who knows. But the ECB is paying the price for being late to the party and having to carry on hiking when everyone else is going to go on pause. And you can quite clearly see from the infamous sources that come out afterwards, and you get the real picture, that she nearly lost the governing council, I think. And Isabel Schnabel's view is clearly dominating, along with Nigel from the Bundesbank and possibly, you know, quite a few other of the more.
So, Marcus, why? Why did the ECB feel like they need to go so hard? I was actually reading something from TD Securities, and don't laugh when I say this, but they were saying, like, hey, maybe the winter crisis with gas won't be that bad. Or, hey, maybe they have confidence in their anti-fragmentation tools.
Oh, that is funny. if we knew what they were, someone still has yet to explain to me, and Nagard certainly has avoided explaining to us what on earth they are. But with regard to, it's one word, inflation, and their upgrading of their forecasts significantly, particularly, you know, the core numbers out of 2025 are quite a bit above their target. They've only got, you know, rates at 2%. They've got to do more. And they've got to keep on doing it because they were late, didn't start hiking till July. The question for me, though, is how can they place all the bonds they have to place next year? We've got best part of 300 billion bunts alone. Because who's going to buy these European government bonds next year? Because it's not going to be the domestic banks, because the Teltro being collapsed, they've got far less firepower to do it. We know the Japanese continue to sell. And therefore, we're left, and the ECB itself is actually now doing quantitative tightening. So, you know, it leaves a very sort of smaller client base for all this debt to be sold at the same time as they can continue to be hiking interest rates. It's not
how big
nice.
Is the risk of a policy mistake here then?
Oof. Well, I mean, their forecast for growth next year at 0.5% is what I would call brave, ambitious, and highly unlikely. I think they're going to push themselves over the edge into recession if they're not already. And the chance, therefore, they may make a policy mistake is quite high. For the moment, though, they have no option. They have to keep on hiking. They left it too little, too late, and they've got to get on with it.
So if they do wind up seeing divergence, though, with, say, the Fed and the BOE, for example, what kind of volatility does that inject into the market? And, like, where do we see that play out the most? I'm assuming it's going to come in BTPs and bunds. What do you see evolving there?
Yeah, exactly that. I think that's the weak point. You know, the only good news for BTPs is there's a lot of supply coming in Germany, so the relative difference isn't quite as big as it used to be. But I think as bunds push higher in yield, which they're looking never to be going to, it will only push BTP yields even further and wider. And that is something which we get the tipping point again, and we get to close to 5% where the wheels start to come off for the debt dynamic sustainability for Italy. And, you know, unpleasant, nasty things are going to happen.
Why do you think the Bank of England is getting near to the end of of its programme of hiking? The labour market in this country continues to be problematic and remains very, very tight. There have been hints from various senior officials at the Bank of England that they're worried that inflation expectations are becoming unanchored. The labour market appears to be, in this country and over in the United States, impervious to policy action. And there's various different reasons for it, but it appears to be the reality. And if that is the case, then that's going to embed inflation. That has the potential to embed inflation into the system for much longer.
Yeah, true. But I mean, the point is, you know, interest rate hikes of 50 basis points or whatever aren't going to kick people out of jobs, which is seemingly what they want. You know, companies have got to go bankrupt on quite a large number to force, you know, really quite a sizable change in turning the labour market. Unfortunately, when it turns, it's already too late. But, you know, looking at the UK, I mean, there are 5 million people sitting there not working, you know, who are capable of working in theory. So, I mean, the labour stats, particularly in the UK, because that's one of our priorities, are useless. And they've been useless for quite a long while. We had no idea how many people left through COVID, but no idea how many people come back. It's all up in the air. As far as relying on statistics to try and look in the rearview mirror to guide policy is at the best useless. The only thing I can say is it means probably, therefore, any recession which we're in is going to be relatively mild, and therefore, e.g., I don't think house prices go down as much. But, you know, beyond that, I think trying to rely on labour stats is a very dangerous thing because they're always lagging and I think very inaccurate.
Let's talk about the labour story from a different angle right now. UK nurses have gone on strike today. We're going to see ambulance workers going on strike tomorrow. It looks as if a baggage handler's strike at Heathrow has been called off. I think the Eurostar strike has also been called off. But clearly, we are in what appears to be potentially a kind of winter of discontent scenario. The rail strikes not happening today, but they're going to be back on tomorrow. It looks like we're going to see more of those as well. Eamon Farrat joining us now. He is our Bloomberg Strikes reporter. He is the man to talk to about all of this. this is the week where it all appears to be coming together. But I'm getting the sense as well that the government is looking to treat some of these different strikes differently. The Daily Mail front page today was maybe indicative of this. There appears to be maybe a willingness to settle with maybe the nurses, but not with the rail workers.
Yeah, I mean, it's maybe about public opinion. You know, when we did we had a poll that came out on Tuesday that showed that rail workers were only seeing about 35% support amongst the public, whilst for nurses it's more than 50. Mm. And there are, I think, already two Tory MPs who've come forward and said that the nurses should get what they're asking for, you know, this pay rise. So, you know, the frontline workers, the emergency workers, maybe they, you know, need more of us and are more likely to get a pay rise than the rail workers just because of the position they're in.
Can you just break down what each individual union wants? Like, I know the nurses, they're looking, 19% pay raise? Like, what are the distinctions?
So, the nurses, they're looking for, what they're saying, a 5% above kind of RPI, so about 19%, which is, you know, quite high. They've only been offered about 4% from the NHS pay review. And the rail, you know, it's maybe looking more in the 10%+. You know, we have to say that today the TSSA accepted an offer from Network Rail. Yep. The RMT is the only union now that's holding out on that offer and still opposing it. There are talks ongoing, but, you know, that's where we are. And across industries, you know, even today, you know, the baggage handlers, they got an offer of 10.5% that is now going to be put to a vote as well. So that's kind of the range on some sides, but the nurses, it is quite high at 19%.
What is the sense of the impact that this is having on the economy? We're starting to see, I've seen a number of numbers being sort of posted this week by various think tanks about the effect that this is having on the economy.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's definitely, you know, the insecurity around all this. You know, in London, you know, I'm sure you can see the offices are quite empty, restaurants are empty. You know, when strikes happen, especially people who commute in, they just can't come in. Restaurants are feeling the brunt of it. We're seeing bookings, you know, plummeting. And of course, there's the cold as well that's contributing to that. But it's definitely taking a toll in London especially.
So, Marcus, back to you on this. How does the BOE manage all of this? Like, a 19% pay raise? Like, that can't be good. But on the other hand, like, how do you not raise wages when it comes to inflation anyway?
Yeah, I don't think the Royal College of Nurses has done themselves any favours by going that high. And I think that's made the government's case, if there is such a thing, easier for them. But as far as the Bank of England is concerned, I mean, they did point quite, you know, carefully to the 6.9% rise in private sector wage growth, mm-hmm. which is more that they sort of focus on because that's sort of the stuff they want to influence, really. The government, in theory, is supposed to look after and take care of itself, though obviously is having some troubles at the moment. So I don't think they look at it with real fear at the moment. They are conscious of it. It's the one thing that might derail their, so we say, only doing a further 25 basis points, if really this does continue to be persistent, which it does have, you know, clearly quite high at 6.9%. Inflation is higher than that. It will come down pretty sharply. We know and expect it to the second half of this year is going to drop almost like a stone. And I think by next year, we're going to be, they're already forecasting it to be below their 2% target. And that's their problem. I think they realise that the amount of hiking they've already done and QT, both active and passive, that they've probably done quite a lot. Hence why two of the members actually voted for no move, which means that next time around, they could start to even voting for rate cuts. So there's a big split on the MPC, and it's really the Labour stats which is causing the problems.
Eamon, just to wrap things up with you, is this as bad as it gets this week?
I think it's pretty bad this week. I mean, especially the rail strikes, that's the one that has the most effect on people's lives. You know, the thing with the NHS, you know, the nurses have already said that they might be calling for more strikes in January if, you know, the government doesn't start wanting to talk about pay. So we could see those nurse strikes expand. Right now, it's not across all trusts. It's only across about 54 of the areas. It could be across many more areas of the UK and the ambulances, as you said, tomorrow. So I think the healthcare side could get worse. The transport could be as bad in January as well.
So you're not done yet, Guy. This is you.
That's basically the message. That's the message I'm getting here. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe you'll have some days where it'll be better, and then other days is when it's not. Really great reporting, you guys. Marcus, just quick question here. In terms of the asset prices, is the market accurately priced for what the BOE is going to run into?
Oh, it's a searching question. I think gilt yields are too low, and I think we're seeing the sharp moves today in Europe. Is something which at some point the UK is going to get to catch up with. So, but there's some strange things going on because the Bank of England sold back a lot of bonds that it bought, in the crisis in September, October. So, you know, it's a bit odd looking at gilt yields, but net, I think they will probably do less badly than European government bonds, but they're still going to rise in yield, therefore down in price. And as far as the FTSE is concerned, again, I think it's just noodling around the 7,400, 500 price. So I'm not I've got a particularly strong view on UK assets. I think the pound is also going to wallow a bit as well, though.
Okay. Marcus, Eamon, thank you both very much indeed. We greatly appreciate it. Up next, we're going to get more analysis on what is happening, particularly with the ECB. Jan Arandau is going to join us from Frankfurt to give us her expert assessment of why we got that incredibly hawkish press conference from Christine Lagarde. That's next. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
We judge that interest rates will still have to rise significantly at a steady pace to reach levels that are sufficiently restrictive to ensure a timely return of inflation to our 2% medium-term target. Our future policy rate decisions will continue to be data-dependent and follow a meeting-by-meeting approach.
That was Christine Lagarde at her epic press conference saying that she was data dependent, but really it felt like the ECB was being very clear in how they were forecasting more 50 basis point hikes for longer and a higher terminal rate. And it was obvious to expect those big hikes. I want to get more analysis here because we saw yields flying higher. The euro seemed confused. At one point it did rally and then it dropped like a stone. So we want to get more insight as to how we interpret all of this going forward. Jan Arandau is Bloomberg's ECB editor and she joins us now. Jana, why do you think Christine Lagarde was this hawkish?
Well, first of all, the inflation projections, right? So the ECB published new forecasts and they show inflation above the 2% target all the way into 2025. And now we know that forecasts this far out are not all that reliable. But it clearly shows that what markets are pricing, which is basically what is baked in those forecasts, is not enough. And that was the message from Christine Lagarde today to investors, to traders, saying what you are pricing, what you expect us to do is not enough. We are determined to bring down inflation. So what she said is more interest rate hikes of 50 basis points, definitely in February, probably in March, and then we will see. So very hawkish of a message, which you have to also see in context of the smaller, of the slowdown in interest rate hikes, right? So we got a half point hike today that was slower than the 75 basis points moves that we saw in September and October. It was very much in line with what other central banks were doing over the past 24 hours. But clearly a slowdown in the hiking pace could have be perceived by observers, by watchers, as you know, a pivot, as a slowdown. And she was very clear saying, we are not pivoting. We are not done. And quite frankly, we are pushing ahead.
How's it going on the governing council, do you think? What's going on below the surface?
Well, it's not all that that much of a party, you know. So we know that more than a third of governors would have actually been in favor of a stronger hike. They wanted 75 basis points, and we know who the hawks are. So we can all make some educated guesses there. But what ultimately brought them around was the strong language on interest rates going forward, on the fact that the ECB is not going to be done in February after another, say, 25 basis point hike, and it's probably not even going to be done in the first quarter. So that commitment that rate hikes will, and significant rate hikes will continue for longer, made them compromise. And also, of course, the start of quantitative tightening in the first quarter in March. That was, if you ask me, a lot more detail than I would have expected going into the meeting. Mm-hmm. So that is also a win for the hawks. Now, the runoff is going to be capped at 15 billion a month on average until the end of the second quarter and being reassessed probably in June. But the pure fact that this is starting now and that they can test the waters, they can see how the market reacts, and that commitment on rate hikes going forward is probably what convinced a lot of those hawks to say, okay, fine, we're going to support mm-hmm. that half point hike today.
What also really strikes me, too, is the growth forecast for next year of half a percentage point, which is what the Fed has in for the U.S., too, which seems bananas to me. So does the 0.5% imply, like, the super soft landing from the ECB or, like, de facto? Does it mean they can't actually hike as much?
I mean, a lot of people would probably say it's a bit of wishful thinking. But
we
if
say
you look
bananas
at
here. But, you know, whatever. It's the same.
So what the ECB sees is a contraction in economic output of 0.2% in the fourth quarter and 0.1% in the first quarter and growth after that. So an incredibly shallow recession, which a lot of economists that, you know, we speak to say, you know, that recession... Nobody sees the economy falling off a cliff, but they do see a somewhat stronger contraction. Some of them, or in fact, most of them actually even see, a contraction in GDP for the whole year of 2023. So the ECB is on the optimistic side. And of course, they're taking into account fiscal measures, helping households with energy bills that will prop up spending. So we'll have to see. We'll have to see how we get through the winter. And you know how we come out on the other side, and then we'll all be a bit smarter.
Will we though?
I hope so. I hope you're right. I'd love to be a bit smarter. Jana, talk to me about what the view from Italy is of all of this. The implicit message today was rates are going significantly north of 3%, which is where the market was previously, maybe up towards 4%. BTPs are already trading at 4%. Can the Italian market take much more of this? And do we think that the ECB's anti-fragmentation tools are going to be able to cope?
Well, clearly the Italian government isn't happy, and we've seen a little bit of that already. But looking at the market side... So far, before going into the meeting, Italian government bonds have been incredibly stable. And as long as the government sticks to being responsible on fiscal policy, does its homework, implements the reforms, outlined, there is a good chance that markets will actually also calm down after today. That's not to say there isn't risk. Mm-hmm. I mean, Italy is the weak spot, and we all know that. But also, the ECB has been very determined in saying, look, there is a backstop. There are actually two backstops that are in place, that are available should things go south. And one, of course, is the flexible reinvestment policy they have under the pandemic program. They have the TPI. So there is a backstop. And I would say, I wouldn't worry too much. There's a lot of noise probably going to come, but we'll get through this.
Jana, great stuff as ever. We've appreciated the fantastic coverage today. Thank you to you and your team. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. He's actually joining me this time, you guys, I promise. The S&P is off by about 2.5%. I mean, it is getting really ugly out there. We are below the 100-day moving average. We're approaching the 50-day moving average. And a lot of debate as to what is causing it. Is it the Fed? Is it the ECB? You could also make an argument that this is just book squaring till the end of the year. We're going to get into that in a moment. We spoke to Greg Jensen of Bridgewater. He had some really fascinating insights. I mean, he made me feel a little depressed after the interview, but you'll see what he says. That's the quick snapshot here. As we're halfway through the trading day in the U.S., let's get some other stories with Charlie Pellett.
Hi, thank you very much. Going back to the Bank of England, because BOE said Britain's inflation rate may already have peaked, and that two of its policymakers believe interest rates are already high enough to drain pricing pressure. The U.K. Central Bank lifted its benchmark lending rate a half point this morning to 3.5%, the ninth increase in a year aimed at taming soaring prices and the highest since the start of the global financial crisis in 2008. National Grid will be running a test of one of the country's coal-fired power generators tomorrow that is being kept in reserve to boost supplies this winter. While mostly phased out already, plants burning the most polluting fossil fuel could serve as a vital source of backup power this winter to make up for potential shortfalls in wind or interconnector capacity as the region struggles with its worst energy crisis in decades. Baggage handlers at London Heathrow Airport have called off a strike strike that was planned for tomorrow after their union got an improved pay offer from their employer. The U-turn means a three-day walkout that was set to begin at 4 a.m. Friday will not take place as the Unite Union ballots members on the new offer. Financial details were not disclosed. That is the latest from the news desk. Alex Steele, back to you now here in New York.
All right, Charlie Pellett, thank you very much. So yesterday, Guy, we were talking about the conversation of which is going to be more hawkish, the Fed or the ECB. I was kind of leaning towards the ECB. It looks like it was the ECB. What do you think is moving the markets here in the U.S., Fed or ECB?
I think it's the ECB.
I agree.
And that's weird because that doesn't normally happen. But the market ignored the Fed yesterday. In fact, it slightly loosened financial conditions and boom, in comes Christine Lagarde. And oh my Lord.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, maybe a little bit of softness in equity, sure, but I just really question why that front end didn't really move that much either. And if, you know, this year was the year that central banks started raising rates, it feels like next year is going to be when the economy starts to feel the effect of those central banks raising rates.
Yeah, and that was the point that Greg Jensen was making to us from Bridgewater. He's the co-CIO a little bit earlier on. He feels that next year you're going to see that impact rolling through. But my question on the back of that, Alex, is... but what happens if central banks keep tightening and continue to tighten or at least hold rates at elevated levels through 2023? That means that we could be looking for this downturn to last into 2024, maybe even longer.
Yeah, and sort of if the puts are really gone, central bank puts are really gone, where does that leave us? And that's, as you mentioned, Greg Jensen, he's the co-CIO over at Bridgewater Associates. We spoke to him earlier in our television program, and we talked about, should we forget about the Fed and just listen to the ECB? And he had a pretty grim outlook as to what he's expecting for the next few years.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'd say there's more similarity here in that central banks are in a much different position than they've been entering the last four recessions, in that they have, their tools are very limited. They've got to simultaneously balance the preventing inflation to getting entrenched with what's with the growth story that in Europe in particular is already weakened. In the US, it's beginning to weaken. And basically, that's what we think the story of 2023 is going to be, which is the lagged effect of what happened in 2022. So if you turn back the clock to 2021, when we're sitting here in December, there were a few things everybody was talking about, which is that inflation is going to be transitory. Nobody was expecting much tightening. And the whole effect of the fiscal policy and the very easy monetary policy and the things that came subsequently in the first and second quarter weren't priced in, even though everybody was talking about them. Here, there's a lot of talk about recession, but very little recession priced in. And so we think whether it's the next leg down, particularly in profits, the more of a dollar squeeze as the effect of the tightening, particularly in the U.S., plays through different markets in the world. Those are the big things that we think are not fully priced. So the market priced in the tightening as it occurred over the last year, the movement in real interest rates drove every market. Yep. We think in the next year, it's going to be the effect of all of those things.
Can you give me a sense of the magnitude of that repricing that we're going to see?
Yeah, look, we think it's, this is one of the biggest differences we've seen between what our systematic process that we've built up over the last 40 years measures on the impact on profits and the impact on currencies that we've ever seen. So one of the biggest, once in 15 year kind of pressures. So I think you're going to see relatively large moves as you shift from a world that's fully focused and on the Fed to one that's focused on recession and dollar squeeze that we see coming into the next year.
So what's your playbook for that?
Well, I think the main things are to recognize the type of environment we're in. We're in a multi-year environment that's very difficult for traditional assets, stocks and bonds. So A, being diversified outside of that. B, if you take this, we think this is particularly going to hit in the countries where the inflation problem was bigger and the tightening, more tightening is necessary. That's really US and Europe and the UK. So there are a lot of opportunities in currencies and across the world, if you can diversify better. We think Asia is a little bit better priced and better able to withstand this because they didn't have as much of an inflation shock and didn't unleash as much fiscal policy. And so there's opportunities out there. But the big picture is if you were set up and you need asset prices to go up, you're in a very difficult position.
Yeah. Greg, you talk about, I'm just wondering about the duration of how long this is all going to last. You talk about 23 being about feeling the effects of the lag from 22. But if policymakers, and we heard from Lagarde today kind of implying this, continue to tighten through 23 or at least sit at fairly elevated levels relative to recent history when it comes to rates through 23, how long is the effect of all of this going to be lasting for? Is it 24? Is it 25? How long is this downdraft in assets and asset valuations going to last for?
Yeah, what you see in these periods of higher inflation when central banks ease more slowly into the recession is they last longer and the drawdowns in assets are longer. So we'd expect kind of double the normal length of a recession because the Fed's not going to be at your back for a long time. And that's a big deal. So I'd say this is going to be a long, likely not. I mean, the good news is the leverage in the financial system isn't that bad. So you don't have this cascading effect like in 2008. Instead, you have this long grind that's probably a couple of years. And that asset prices as a result start to price that in. And until that's sort of fully priced in and you, and the central banks are able to move towards easing, you get a recovery much later. So our expectation is that you're in for a long drawdown, that you haven't seen the bottom in risky assets, and that it's going to be a couple year down cycle here.
And Alex, what he was basically talking about as well is that you're seeing the kind of the early volatility in areas. We've seen it in the gilt market, you've seen it in crypto, but that process is also going to work its way to the kind of the center of financial markets. And that's going to be a fairly long drawn out process as well.
Yeah, that didn't make me feel very good at all.
No.
His whole description was pretty bleak, too. And he basically was like, cash is good. It's given you something. Like, why not do that? I mean, this is Bridgewater Associates, and they have a really pessimistic view over the next few years. And I just have to wonder, too, as the leverage bubble rolls, like, where does it roll to next? Is it balance sheets? Is it company balance sheets, I guess? Is it central bank balance sheets?
Is it the consumer? There's all kinds of things that are gonna work their way through the system over the next year or so. Particularly as we heard today, central banks keep the pressure on and keep tightening. Anyway, up next we're going to talk about luxury stocks and China.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
Good evening, welcome back. You're listening to The Cable. We are live on DAB, digital radio. We've talked a little bit about the impact that Christine Lagarde was having today on the Eurozone equity market. We also need to talk about the impact China is having. Really poor economic data out of China a little bit earlier on. There's also reports now being done by specialists in Hong Kong looking at healthcare situations, suggesting we could see close to a million deaths as a result of the reopening that we're seeing in China. Will that have an impact on the luxury sector? Well, today we saw the luxury sector in Europe under real pressure. Names like Kering down very, very hard. The owner of Gucci down by 5.57%. We saw analysts over at Bryan Garnier talking about the fact that Kering is in particular exposed through Gucci to China. Alex and I caught up with Sweta Ramachandran from GAM. She's our go-to expert on luxury to get her take on all of this.
I think the luxury sector today definitely has been down in sympathy with a lot of other growth stocks in Europe following the ECB rate hikes and more generally concerns about the trajectory of rate hikes in Europe. I do think the China data is a little bit backward looking in that it's well understood that November was well before the sort of path to reopening began. And this share has actually reacted quite positively to early news of an eventual reopening that appears to be underway, which signals a catalyst for the luxury sector in terms of demand recovering into early next year. So while this is a short-term concern, I think the bigger issue with China is the longer-term path of the reopening and to what extent in 2023 that can help the support the sector, which may be affected by slower demand in the US and Europe.
The note that Alex is referring to basically signals that Kering has greater exposure to China through Gucci. Is that how we should be viewing luxury names? Looking through the portfolios, looking through LVMH, looking through other brands, looking at their exposure, figuring out kind of how that exposure works, and then backing that into the price that we're prepared to pay. Is that going to be the name of the game next year?
To some extent, absolutely. I would point out that Kering has been suffering from some specific Gucci-specific issues in that that brand is more reliant on a younger consumer cohort in China than perhaps other brands. And it is in some need of rejuvenation, which is why the designer who has left is about to be replaced by another. And that is hopefully going to catalyze a recovery for that brand. That said, China is definitely going to be a key catalyst for the sector in 2023, given that there used to be a huge component of luxury spend by Chinese nationals that before the pandemic was taking place outside of China as tourists traveled, especially in Europe and other parts of Asia. That virtually came to a standstill. And even though demand in China grew significantly in 2020 and 2021, it's not completely offset the impact of that lost tourism.
That was Swetha Ramachandran joining us from GAM. You know, but I find the China question, and you can really broaden this out to like any asset class, to be very confusing because we're all also looking at the idea that China is going to reopen in the same way that the U.S. and the West did, even if it's choppy, that they're going to spend a ton of money buying stuff. Do we know for sure that that's going to be true? I mean, Swetha says it doesn't really matter because Chinese consumers just buy differently for different reasons than U.S. consumers. But still, I'm puzzled.
And they didn't have the same welfare supports during lockdown as many Western consumers did. One of the big things and one of the most confusing things about, I think, the current picture in the United States is just how much money consumers still have in their pockets to spend, which seems to be supporting the economy at a time when you wouldn't expect it to be doing as well as it is. So I think that's going to be one of the fascinating narratives as well. And just trying to think, understand what impact this is going to have in Europe as well. People have often compared and contrasted LVMH and Apple, and I think that kind of that luxury story could be really interesting for Europe going forward. Europe's never had that tech story, but the luxury story is now there. Bernard Arnault is now the richest man on earth.
I was just going to say that. Like, that to me perfectly encapsulates the LVMH versus Tesla thing. And I appreciate that Elon Musk is not just Tesla because of the whole Twitter thing and there's a reason why he lost a bunch of money, yada, yada. Okay, I get that. But still, just like moving the throne from a Tesla to LVMH, I think says a lot. And many equity strategists think that the value trade within Europe has a lot more legs, that this could be the year. I mean, I've been hearing this for a while, Guy, but they say that this could maybe be the year.
It'd be a very different looking throne, wouldn't it? LVMH and Tesla.
It would be so much. Well, Teslas are pretty fancy. I would totally opt for the LVMH throne.
Exactly.
Shocker. I know. Okay, coming up, we're going to talk more about what the Fed did yesterday and how to position in the market, taking a look at those 2 years. Ira Jersey will be joining us. This is Bloomberg.
This is The Cable with Guy Johnson and Alex Steele on Bloomberg Radio.
A good evening. You are listening to The Cable on Bloomberg DAB Digital Radio. I'm Alex Steele in New York. Guy Johnson is over in London. So we're just almost 24 hours from the event from yesterday. Fed Chair Jay Powell hiking 50 basis points, still sounding really hawkish. Sounding hawkish, the statement read hawkish, the outlook was hawkish, and yet the markets behaved in an odd way. You really didn't see that much hawkish reaction within the bond market, within the equity market, or within the currency market. Now, today, the two-year yield is up by about 3 basis points. The 10-year yield is down 4 basis points. Okay. Is it the Fed? Is it the ECB? What do we make of this? Who's to talk to us? Ira Jersey. He's Bloomberg Intelligence Chief U.S. Rates Strategist. Ira, what is the curve responding to today?
Yeah, so today it's really a combination of both yesterday's Fed, but in particular the ECB this morning. If you look at what's going on in the European bond market, you have a very significant sell-off. You look at German bonds today, and you have 10-year German bonds selling off 15-ish basis points. The front end even more, right? Two-year yields up 24 basis points or so the last time I looked, which was a couple of minutes ago now, so it may have moved. So definitely the hawkishness out of the ECB is affecting the U.S. market right now, particularly that front end. The back end, you know, is more, I think, domestic. It's basically the idea that if central banks are going to be hawkish now, that means they're going to have to be more dovish later. And so that's why you get this, you can't call it bull or bear flattening anymore, right? Because it's bull and bear flattening at the same time.
What?
He sounded really excited when he said that, by the way.
He did.
Yeah.
Ira, how does this work its way through now? The Bunds in particular have been asleep at the wheel, I think, in terms of recognizing the risk. Is the Treasury market making the same mistake as well? The central banks have sounded, the Fed maybe a little bit less so, the ECB maybe a little bit more so, have sounded very hawkish over the last 24 hours. And they are clearly trying to communicate to the message to the market that you are underpricing the risk of what we want to do next.
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of that. And certainly central banks want to see higher interest rates because they want to make sure that they can try to get inflation under control. I think the The issue that both markets and the central bank have, and the markets in particular right now, are saying, look, over the last 35 years, since 1987, we've been trained that when either the market crashes significantly or we get a higher unemployment rate, that we know the Fed's going to cut. And the problem is that it hasn't gotten through the market's vernacular yet that put it doesn't exist anymore, mm-hmm. or that it's, as I describe it, it's just further out of the money. You need to see a much deeper economic yep. slowdown or much deeper market distress in order for central banks to think about cutting. But I think it's going to take actions, right? I think mm-hmm. at this point, the Fed's, the market's not going to believe central banks until they actually take action, or in the case of the Fed, don't take action once they reach the peak in yields.
So what do you think that's going to look like in terms of, say, the unemployment rate? Like, they know they forecasted 4.6%, but, like, what's the pain point where we're going to start to believe them?
Yeah, something above 5, right? So okay. I think
like, really, it goes above 5, they don't act.
Yeah, so you know, there's a lot of debate about what the natural, you know, non-accelerating rate of inflation, of unemployment is, and where
otherwise,
those numbers
Nehru.
Are. Nehru, right. And whether or not the you know, how will 4.6% unemployment, how will that affect wage growth and wages? And in the U.S. in particular, you know, wages are non-trivial. And you did hear Jay Powell talk about this. We've been talking about it. I actually just read a piece that I wrote back in July saying that the Fed was going to have to go more because of what's going on in services, both wages and employment and prices. And the service sector wage growth in the U.S. is still running at like over 7% on an annualized basis. You know, that means that services businesses are going to have to increase their prices in order to maintain margins. And that just means that can be much stickier. And the thing about services, we have to remember, they're not things that you typically buy on credit. So mm-hmm. it's not something that interest rate increases one way or the other are going to affect, right? You buy a house,
that's
you
really
buy a car,
point.
Big ticket items on credit.
Right. Like, you have to lose your job to stop doing those things.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So how does this play out, do you think? What does the beginning of next year look like? Today we've seen a kind of a bit of a rupture in perceptions of the ECB. Do you think the Fed's going to look at the reaction that the ECB has got today and think, I want some of that?
maybe a little, but keep in mind is that throughout most of this cycle, the Fed has been about 6 months in front of the ECB and even at some level, the Bank of England as well. So I think, you know, the Fed is – the challenge that Powell and the rest of the Fed members have had over the last couple of months is how do we communicate the fact that we're going to be stopping our interest rate hikes at some point in the foreseeable future, and at the same time, we're not going to be quick to ease. They've said it. The market doesn't believe it, right? And that's the challenge that I think they continue to have. So I think Jay Powell just has to say, like, look at the summary of economic projections. Look at the dot plot. We think at the end of next year, keep in mind, this is not the average of the year. This is not we're going to hike to 5.25% and then cut. This is saying we think at the end of next year, we're going to be at 5.1%. It's really 5.25% on the upper bound, mm-hmm. but 5.1% on the Fed funds rate at the end of 2023. And he has to really pound that and keep saying it. And what that means is it's not so much that we'll necessarily see a significant re-steepening of the yield curve, mm-hmm. right? The yield curve, I think, for all of next year, or almost all of next year, is going to remain inverted, but it might eventually remain less inverted because as the Fed keeps the rate at 5.1%, we're going to price for even deeper cuts in 2024. So it's kind of this odd dynamic that at the beginning of the year, Guy, to your question, beginning of the year, I think we continue to flatten the yield curve. We continue to get the twos tens curve to about negative 100 basis points. And then at that point, maybe we start to think about whether or not we want to get into steepening positions.
So you have a model that shows like his actual words during a press conference.
Alex is very excited.
He's like, I've had this for a while. But are you going to have to adapt it now to like silence or when he shuffles papers or like when he clears his throat? I mean, is that what we're really into right now?
Well, we always look at nuance and at the Brookings Institution, people told me that like the tone of what he said and the way he said some of the words sounded very dovish. The fact that he was talking about bike rides, when he was asked about bike rides, he didn't say it. It was a question.
It's crazy.
But it was crazy. But nonetheless, like that model, that NLP model that we had showed that he was dovish then. And yesterday, interestingly, it actually didn't show that he was more hawkish. It showed he was exactly the same as last month.
Interesting. Interesting. Ira, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Ira Jersey of Bloomberg Intelligence. Okay, that wraps it up. Guy, it was such a pleasure to have you back on the show this week. I'm serious. All right, we will be here tomorrow again, or I will be. You've been listening to The Cable. Have a good night. This is Bloomberg.